Well, agroforestry has been practiced around the world for centuries, including right here in the Midwest. I'm Jill Nadeau, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. With us is Jacob Grace. He's a communications project manager for the Savannah Institute, which is a nonprofit organization working with farmers and scientists to spread agroforestry throughout the Midwest. And with him is Jen Ripp. She is education coordinator for the Savannah Institute, and Jen also manages a vast diversity of apple tree varieties in the Seed Savers Exchange Orchard in Decorah, Iowa. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. Hi, Jen.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Yes, you too. So, you listening, what are your questions about growing crops right along trees and shrubs? What do you want to know about new ideas and research in agriculture? Join the conversation. Our number is 800-642-1234 or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. So again, thank you both for being here. And let's just start out for those who are not quite sure, what is agroforestry? Jacob, why don't you take that?
Thank you. Yeah, simply put, agroforestry is farming with trees. So that's kind of the quick and dirty definition. But it's basically using trees for any type of agricultural purpose. And there can be a whole lot of different reasons to use trees on farms. One of the most obvious ones being growing them for fruit or for nuts that you get off of the trees. But they can also provide shade for livestock. They can provide windbreaks and interrupt the flow of water, kind of keep water on your farm. They can be used for a lot of other things that we can talk more about if we have time.
Oh, we've got plenty of time. So you can go ahead and tell us all about it. So, Jen, tell us about what your job is as education coordinator, because that's pretty important to your mission, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah. So as education coordinator, I actually also coordinate the apprenticeship program, which I can talk more about later as well. But education is pivotal in the widespread adoption of agroforestry. It's not new technology, but it is technology that I see a lot of farms moving into or needing to move into as climate change happens. Okay. So basically, I'm taking farmers or maybe people that want to start farming and showing them the ways of agroforestry, the benefits of perennial agriculture and diversified crops on their land. So that ranges quite a bit. Right now, if you go onto our website, we do have 8 online course modules that are free of charge. So you can just kind of work through them at your own rate. And we are here to answer questions.
And that's what people need right now, isn't it? To know more about it. So it sounds like a great resource for everyone who's interested in that. What's the history of agroforestry, Jacob?
Yeah, agroforestry is probably one of the earliest forms of agriculture. So for a lot of people, agroforestry sounds like a new term. Here in the Midwest, we're often talking to people about it as, you know, kind of introducing it to them as a new thing. But it's really been something that's been happening around the world for, you know, centuries. And, you know, back in the day when people would turn their hogs or other livestock into forests to kind of clean up the nuts and stuff that fell down, that was, you know, the early steps onto what became agriculture, and that was agroforestry, working with the trees as part of that system. So it has a long history. It takes different forms in different parts of the world. So tropical agroforestry is, you know, something that we don't deal with in the Midwest,
right.
But has an even, you know, it's a much longer, you know, in many ways is far ahead of where we're at here in the Midwest. You know, kind of zooming in more to the present, you know, agroforestry is not very widespread in the Midwest, but there are a number of farms here in Wisconsin and places like Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, farms that have been experimenting with agroforestry for several decades now. And in a lot of ways, they've kind of figured out what not to do, which is sometimes
helpful.
that's sometimes the most helpful part, is learn the things that don't work. And that's kind of how the Savannah Institute came to be, too, is that, you know, we're next year, 2023, will be our 10th anniversary as an organization. So we're a pretty young organization. The organization started because some of these farms that have been doing this stuff for several decades now, We could see the farmers getting ready to retire, or, you know, kind of, you know, reaching the end of their careers and trying to think about what's going to happen to their legacy, what's going to happen to all the knowledge they've accumulated, and just the tree varieties they've accumulated too. And, you know, what, how are we going to keep this going and build off this work? And that's kind of how the Savannah Institute came to be.
Okay. And Jen, what do your participants, who do they look like? I mean, who are these new type of farmers?
I would say broadly, it's anyone that's interested in the future of our planet and growing food. So that's hopefully everyone that's listening right now. We all have our roles and our abilities. So I would say anyone that just has an interest in perennial agriculture, or just what the heck agroforestry is going to be our audience. And then once you kind of take a steps into this world, it makes a lot more sense than a lot of the monoculture farming that we are surrounded by. So really just being on the precipice of this like very, very momentous movement into regenerative agriculture, to concentrating on soils. I would say like at the core, it's tree nerds, but also soil nerds, water nerds, anyone that wants to kind of change, correct course a little bit from the agriculture that we have right now.
Sure. We'll take all nerds.
Or anybody that doesn't call themselves a nerd. That's fine too.
Yeah. You don't even have to be a nerd.
we use it lovingly.
Yes, we do. So how did we get here? How did we get to this mono farming stuff? I mean, where did our trees go that used to be between the fields? I mean, I remember that. And how did all that change? Jacob, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a big question that I can hear Jen laughing.
I'm glad Jacob's answering that.
maybe too big for this show, but you know, a lot of economic forces and policy forces kind of combining to shape things the way they are. And I think one of the one of the ways that we talk about this, and I think something that I experience having, you know, I grew up on a farm, and Jen has family that farm here in the Midwest. And, the current system that is happening on a lot of acres in the Midwest is not necessarily something that a lot of farmers chose. In many cases, it's something that they're mm-hmm. kind of
forced into.
Forced, or that kind of just, you know, got on the track and then didn't know, you know, didn't see a place to turn off. And so something that we think about a lot at the Savannah Institute is diversity, which often we think of, you know, diversity of crops, diversity of livestock, but diversity of income sources is something that farmers mm-hmm. are really thinking about right now. And if you're working with something like trees, you could use those trees for fruits and nuts. You could mm-hmm. use those trees for lumber. You could use them for raising livestock. You can get a variety of income sources for trees. And I think that's mm-hmm. one thing that agroforestry and other types of perennial agriculture, so things like managed grassland, managed grazing, things where there are multiple ways you can get an income source off of this, as opposed to what a lot of acres are now in production, where there's really only one way to make money off of that. And if the markets aren't mm-hmm. good, then you're in trouble.
For sure. Like, don't put your mm-hmm. eggs in one basket, right?
Exactly.
your actual eggs.
Your actual real eggs.
I wanted to add quick to a quote that I'd heard recently of sustainable farming can be sustainable for the land, but if it's not sustainable for the farmer with these like diversified income streaks, then diversity to the land and the sustainability of the land is going to be impacted by that. So I really like that Savannah Institute puts a lot of its resources into market expansion and just the general adoption team. So there's like a research facet, but also the adoption is huge. We can have a ton of trees, but if we don't know where to sell them, then it's not going to be widely adopted.
Very true. We do have a caller, Becky in Ryle. Hi, Becky. What's your question?
Hello. So I'd like to know more about nut trees and trees for energy production. What are the nut trees that are going to work in Wisconsin, and mm-hmm. what kind of timeline is there? And are they very intensive for I want something less intensive than growing fruit crops.
Yep.
Are there trees? I know you can grow like switchgrass for energy, but what about trees for energy?
Ooh, well, yeah. Jacob, do you want to take this one?
Sure. I'll give a first shot at it, and then Jen, you can jump in if I miss anything. So, the Savannah Institute has done some work to kind of figure out, there are a wide variety of trees that will grow in the upper Midwest, but try to figure out like what are the, dozen or fewer trees that we really want to focus our energy on. And for nut trees too, that we work with a lot are, chestnut varieties and hazelnut varieties. I won't give the full backstory on those, but chestnut trees used to be very common in the U.S. Chestnut blight came through and pretty much wiped them out. They're pretty much gone, but through mixing some of the genetics of American chestnut trees with Chinese and different European and Asian varieties, we can get chestnut trees that survive and thrive in the United States. In Wisconsin, we are starting to run into the northern range of chestnuts, but that's one tree that we're working with a lot, especially in Iowa and Illinois. And then hazelnuts are another tree that where there's a lot of mixing of varieties from the U.S. and from Europe and Asia to try to find varieties that will do well in our climates, will resist the disease and pest pressures we have, and also be easy to harvest, because again, getting back to the income sources things, we don't want to be spending a ton of energy on things that are really hard to harvest. So chestnut trees are more of that long-term investment. A number of the farms we work with are planting chestnut trees, mm-hmm. and saying, this is something we want to give to our children or leave for our grandchildren as these people are retiring. Hazelnuts are a little bit quicker turnaround. They're kind of, some of them are more of a bush than a tree. And we're having a lot of making some progress in doing some of the machine harvesting with hazelnuts, so that that's a big thing we talk about with all these agroforestry crops is how are you going to harvest it without having to go and pick everything yourself? So chestnuts and hazelnuts, I think I'll stop there and see if Jen has anything she wants to.
Okay, Jen, add. Why don't you add to that? And we've got like a minute and a half before we have to break for news. So,
yeah, sure. I guess the one that I'll add is walnuts and different species of hard nuts and butternuts. There's a hybrid. A lot of our research is taking from the work and sharing the work of a lot of amazing nut tree breeders from the upper Midwest. And so that gives you things like a Bart nut, which is a butternut and a heart nut hybrid, and kind of just all of these clever ways that we can start producing more nuts in the upper Midwest to not have to import them, to give people a sustainable source of income. And I'm actually forgetting the second part of the question.
It had to do with energy, and I thought, we can address that when we come back. So start thinking about it. Okay. We're talking with Jacob Grace and Jen Ripp of the Savannah Institute. What questions do you have about agroforestry? Are you doing that on your farm? Well, we'd like to hear from you. So give us a call at 800-642-1234, and we'll be right back to talk about the energy part of that question right after this look at the news. So stay with us. Well, we're taking a look at agroforestry on the Larry Mueller Show today. I'm Jill Nadeau, and thanks for spending time with us on the Ideas Network. With us today are Jen Ripp and Jacob Grace. Jen is the education coordinator, and Jacob is the communications project manager for the Savannah Institute. It's a nonprofit organization working with farmers and scientists to spread agroforestry throughout the Midwest. Are you a farmer interested in agroforestry? Do you have questions about this type of farming? You'll give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. org. So before we went for the break, we didn't quite finish that question from our caller about growing things for energy purposes. So now that you've had 5 minutes to think about it, Jen, do you have something for us?
Sure. Yeah, well, I'll say there's a lot of research being done right now in the field of bioenergy. We're hoping that perennials will be able to contribute to that, whether it's switchgrass or even more woody perennials. I would invite you to tune into the Perennial Farm Gathering. We have a couple of segments dedicated more or less to the idea of bioenergy and carbon sequestering, too. These are very new subject matters that are going to take a lot of discussion to be able to determine the best practice and best course of action. I know for the perennial, for perennial bioenergy crops, there's a lot of research being done by American Farmland Trust as well as Iowa State to see kind of where that balance is between taking from the land, but then also giving back to the land and making sure we're not removing all of the biomass that really is there to build the soil and to continue feeding the plants in a beautiful circle. So it's a really interesting discussion. I'm fascinated by the amount of progress that sort of bioenergy has made in the last like 5 or 10 years. And it'll be exciting to see what happens with it.
Yes, definitely. I know we've done a number of programs on that, and there's so much out there that that's being worked on. So you mentioned the Perennial Farm Gathering, Jen. Jacob, why don't you tell us when that is, what it is, and who can join in?
Yeah, so that's going to be coming up December 7th through 9th, and it's going to be fully online this year. So we had been, you know, doing it in person up until 2020, and now we've shifted over to fully online, and we're sticking with that format partly because it does open it up to the people who are able to attend. This is a gathering we intentionally try to avoid calling it a conference because a lot of people try to think of it as a conference, but it really is a place where we want to get people together who have experience with agroforestry or who want to learn more about agroforestry and not have it feel like a professional networking thing,
sure.
but
mm-hmm.
really have it be a place where, you know, farmers and researchers and landowners and other people can get together and talk about what they're doing. And so we really try to design it with that in mind where, you know, we start out the first day by having what we call the nutshell session, which is where anyone who attends can get up and talk for 5 minutes about what they've been doing. So just talk about their work in a nutshell. And the goal is to really just learn from each other and learn from everyone who's there. Yeah, I do want to pass that question on to Jen since she's been the major force organizing this year's
event. Okay. Give us nuts and bolts.
Sure, yeah. Well, long time fan of the Perennial Farm Gatherings, first time planner of that. first one I attended, I think I met you, Jacob, I'm pretty sure I did in 2019. It was the last one in person.
Yeah, because you attended before you ever worked for Savannah Institute, right?
Yeah, I was selling annual seeds at that point, and I was like, can I bring a bunch of annual seeds to a perennial farm gathering? And Jacob's like, yeah, we still eat tomatoes. So people still need them.
Yes.
But yeah, this year is going to be really wonderful. I kind of feel like I got permission to throw a big party of all the things I'm interested in and then invite a lot of my colleagues and coworkers and partnerships to participate too. So this year it'll be all online, as Jacob was saying. It's 26 sessions total. Two of those will be the nutshells and kind of following on the last conversation with RuMap about like connecting, like this is how we connect to each other. Like there's connection to the land. And then there's in this sense, like connection to each other who are all connected to the land. So it's really, really just about like seeing what else is going on out there. Cause a lot of these fields are just really new and like very, very innovative folks in this crowd for sure. But a couple of highlights I wanted to talk about is that Ricardo Salvador is going to be our keynote. He is a real treat. He is, I believe, the president for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He's a friend of Savannah Institute's, and I am so excited to hear him speak. That's going to be on the last day. But I think we're all in for a ride for Ricardo kind of telling us like it is, which if you've heard him speak before, can be like provocative and inspiring. And then another couple of ones is a Samantha Bosco. She's a researcher out of Cornell, and she has this group called Research is Nuts, which
about nuts. We make the most of our puns.
I get a theme here, yes. Yeah.
I've been a big fan of her work, and she's going to have a discussion kind of in the more or less the history of nuts in this country. And then there's several really interesting panels that I put together around key fields in the work that we do, such as silvopasture, alley cropping. And then the ones I'm really excited about are land access. How do you plant trees without access to land? So there's many different models of that and a lot to consider when either transitioning your land or looking for land. And then regenerative finances, so kind of these new approaches to financing a lot of these projects that don't have the same timeline as annual crops. It's a whole different game when you start looking at production being 10 years down the road versus that year. So yeah, I'm really excited. If you'd like to join us, you can follow to our website. We'll hope to see you there. And again, that's December 7th through the 9th.
7th through the 9th, okay. And that's, what is that, like a Friday through Sunday or something like that? Or
It's a Wednesday through Friday.
Oh, okay.
Kind so of the like, who's going to, but it's all going to be recorded too. So every session will be recorded. There's going to be a lot of room for discussion too. Kind of, again, trying to mimic the in-person nature of like, after you hear a really great speaker, you want to go up and ask them questions and talk about your work and then talk about their work some more. So every like Zoom session will be left open for that kind of more natural gathering feel to it versus a webinar or something like that. There's ample room for question and answer with these.
Great. And your email or I'm sorry, web address is?
We can give the main website is savannahinstitute.org.
Okay.
That's Savannah with no H. 2 N's, 3 A's. You can just Google Savannah Institute and it will probably be us.
Okay. Or you can go to our website because we do have a link there. So you can go to WPR.org/Larry, look for this episode, and right underneath the description, you'll see related links and you can follow that. So lots of ways to find out about it. Is there a charge?
There is, go ahead, Jen.
there is a fee. We did just past our early bird pricing. But one important thing about Savannah Institute is we also offer it at any price. So sliding scale, if you would like to participate and you can't afford the normal price, that's okay. Maybe you can in the years after, but we really just want this to be accessible to as many people as possible.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for telling us about that. Let's get back into agroforestry a little bit. How does it actually help, you know, not only the farmer and the land, but how does it help communities and maybe the landscapes and watersheds that are involved in this?
Yeah, well, one of the things we end up talking about a lot with agroforestry, and this is true for other types of perennial agriculture too, so growing things that grow for more than 1 year at a time, is it really makes you think about time differently, as funny as that sounds, or think about the future of the land and of your community differently. And so much of the land in the Midwest right now is in some form of annual crop. So every year it kind of starts again from scratch, and people are kind of planning 1 year at a time with that land. And when you're doing something like growing trees, it kind of forces people to think farther into the future of, you know, what is this land, you know, who's going to be living here in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years? You know, what is the climate going to be like? What is the land going to be like? And I think that's not a direct answer to your question, but that's something that, that sounds kind of abstract, but quickly becomes concrete when it comes to things like borrowing money to do agroforestry, where you might not be earning a profit for 5 or 10 years, or things like land access, like Jen was talking about, where, you know, if you need, you know, if you're going to do agroforestry, you're going to need to know that you have control of that land for an extended period of time, not just for the next year. And so I think that's something that I know when I was starting to do this work, I thought I was just going to be helping people plant trees. But as I'm getting farther in, I realize that the, you know, the big thing we're doing is we're kind of making people think a little bit differently, think farther into the future than they usually do. And I think that's something really powerful that agroforestry presents is just kind of an entry point for people to think about that.
Yeah, sometimes we're a little short-sighted, aren't we?
It happens.
So as far as like the watersheds go, though, it's really important because you do have these perennial plantings. What do they do for the soil and for, you know, the environment? Jen, you want to take that one?
Sure. So we can use a fancy terminology there, but like riparian buffers. So that's going to be the perennials planted along waterways, streams, lakes, pretty much anything that has these like deep perennial roots that are going to hold in the soil. But we also have a lot of research going on right now. Our colleagues Nate and Devin are both doing a lot of research into nutrient leaching. So trying to figure out how these roots are in fact preventing these nutrients like nitrate from leaching into waterways, which is a huge issue in much of the state. So kind of how can we really cleverly plant these perennial riparian buffers in order, one, to possibly make the farmer some sort of harvest or money. There's edible riparian buffers, but really their main function is to provide something that keeps the soil in, reduces erosion, and then acts as a filter for the rest of the cropland that sometimes is pretty close to some of those waterways.
Definitely. Well, I love the fact that you are not just telling farmers this is what you have to do, but you're offering resources and advice and examples that, that they can not necessarily, you know, have to foot it all themselves, which is has been the case in a lot of times. So so we've got it. There's some different practices relating to agroforestry, alley cropping, forest farming, silvopasture.
Yep,
is that
yep.
it? Okay.
Why, got it, yeah.
Why don't you explain some of these, Jacob?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about that. And I will add that we hopefully are not telling farmers that they have to do this, that they have to do agroforestry. That's, you know, at this point, we're still in the situation where, fortunately, people are coming to us wanting to do agroforestry. And we do think there's a lot of great stuff about agroforestry. But if people don't want to do it, that's fine,
right.
too. There are a lot of other great options
sure.
out there. But there are a number of different forms that agroforestry can take, especially in here in the Midwest. And the first question we often get, or one of the first questions we get is, you know, what am I going to do with this land, or how am I going to make an income off this land while the trees are growing, while the trees are young? So two of the types of agroforestry that we talk about a lot are silvopasture, as we said, and alley cropping. So alley cropping, I guess I'll talk about first, which is just planting rows of trees within rows of crops. So if you're growing corn, if you're growing soybeans, if you're growing vegetables, you can take one row, you know, every 10th row or whatever it whatever is the right fit, whatever. Usually it depends on the size of your machinery.
I was but just going to say that.
Yep, yeah. You figure out the width of your equipment, and then one row in between you plant to trees, and then those trees start growing, and you keep raising whatever crop you have been growing in between. At some point down the road, the trees will start shading out those crops. And at that point, hopefully you'll also be harvesting off the trees. So it's kind of a steady transition into more agroforestry. This can happen on a really big scale. So we have some demonstration farms in Wisconsin and in Illinois. One of them in Illinois, it's over 100 acres we have planted to alley cropping, where there are trees growing in rows, and they're also last year, I think it was corn. I don't know what they're planning to do next year, but so alley cropping is one great way to get in the door with agroforestry. And the other is silvopasture, which is using livestock instead of crops. There is a negative history, with good reason, of putting livestock in the forest, which can have a lot of harmful consequences. And that's not what silvopasture is. Silvopasture is managing your trees, managing your livestock, and managing your forage, because that's what your livestock are going to need to thrive. And so you can do that by either taking a pasture and planting trees in it, or you can take a poor quality woodland that has a lot of brush or trees you don't want and thin those out and plant in some forage. So then the livestock are in a place that already has the trees, but then they also have the forage to eat. So depending on what type of farming you're already doing, either alley cropping or silvopasture might be a good fit for you.
Okay. And obviously on your website, there's a lot more information about each one of those. We can't talk about farming without talking about climate change. How does this not contribute to, but offset climate change, Jen?
Again, this is a really new field for a lot of the work that we do. We do definitely consider ourselves a climate change agriculture. Just adding a little bit more onto what Jacob was saying, the name Savannah Institute came from the oak savanna and mimicking those systems. So every system is going to be tailored to, one, the farmer, and two, the land that they have it on. So that alone, mind shift from conquering land versus working with it, we're hoping and know is going to have a big effect on climate change. But kind of the brass tacks, I would say, tune into the PFG. We have two researchers that are going to be talking about just the climate market, what agroforestry can do for climate change. That's going to get a little bit into something called carbon sequestering, which is trees taking carbon from the air and then sinking it deep into the soil. And then kind of the difficulties that can come along with that, more on a people scale than a tree scale.
If I can maybe jump in there, we are going to have these sessions where we get into, some of our colleagues are really getting into figuring out the carbon sequestration research and understanding carbon markets. But I think just, it's also important to zoom out a little bit and that, a lot of things like sequestering carbon just come back to soil health. And I think that can be a little bit easier to think about than the intricacies of something like greenhouse gases, which you can't see. It's really hard to understand. And, what's important is having living roots in the ground for as long as possible. And so agroforestry is a way to do that. Well-managed pasture is a way to do that. I think sometimes when we get, I know this happens to me, if I get a little bit too lost in the details, I try to just zoom out and think, we really just need to get more roots in the ground for longer. And that's going to ultimately have the impacts that we want.
Well, that makes sense. How do you guys do this financially, and who's supporting you? Lots of people, I'll bet.
Jen and I look at each other. Yeah.
You take this one.
Yeah. So we're a nonprofit organization. We're funded by a mix of grants and donations. I haven't looked at our latest annual report, which, because we do agroforestry, we call it a perennial report instead of an annual report. But
you guys have a problem.
We make the most of our puns. But a mix of public and private grants and then donations.
Okay. And what about advocating, with legislature and things like that? What are you doing right now?
So we are a nonprofit, so we have to be careful about doing advocacy work. I think we're kind of the only organization that is, in the Midwest focused on agroforestry. So there are definitely other organizations doing agroforestry and doing great work, and we're lucky to work with a lot of them. A lot of great organizations in the Midwest working on some of the things we work on, but agroforestry in the Midwest is kind of our niche. Mm-hmm. And so we're really trying to just play our role there as much as possible. So providing education, we now have a technical service program so that people who have land and want to have someone come in and just kind of tell them what to do, basically, which, is a major need. We're scaling that up. We just got some new funding to scale that up and get some new staff for that. let's see, what am I missing, Jen? The apprenticeship program.
Yeah. And I wanted to make sure you have a minute to talk about Jacob's radio production as well. The apprenticeship program is last year we had 12 apprentices across 10 different farms all across the upper Midwest and even parts of the lower Midwest. So we're doing that every year. Applications will be up by December 15th. So I just encourage folks, if you're interested, any age, any background, we would love you to apprentice.
Great. And literally we have a minute left to talk about your podcast, Jacob. So tell us what it is in a nutshell.
Right. Yep. So we do have a Savannah Institute podcast, the Perennial Agroforestry podcast. If we've shortened it a little bit, but if you search for it, you can find it there. Like I said, we make the most of our puns. Mm-hmm. So
I wasn't quite sure what that stood for, actually.
Agroforestry. Yeah,
stands for agroforestry. It's a chance for mainly for me, but other people on the podcast to just talk a little bit more about what they're doing.
Okay, and where do people find that?
Anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Okay, excellent. And it's called again?
Perennial AF, the Savannah Institute podcast.
Excellent. We love it. Thank you both for being here. We really appreciate it. We've been talking to Jacob Grace and Jen Ripp of the Savannah Institute. And tomorrow at this time, you're going to hear Turkey Confidential because, you know, culinary triage on the day that you need it most is very important. So you can hear all about turkey. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay well.